thank you very much, and many thanks to the Action Board for the invitation to come and share this story. Again, I was asked to come to tell the very specific story about going smoke-free in California, and so we'll take a quick walk down memory lane, and it'll start in California, but I also want to share the national perspective, because clearly this movement began in a number of states at the very local level and really has grown and become not just a national but an international phenomenon. And I think there are some lessons to be shared, and I think also some lessons that tobacco control can also learn from other fields. So without further ado, we'll go ahead and get started. I am, by the way, the Executive Director of Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights and the ANR Foundation. So we have a C4 and a C3. Obviously, one does lobbying and one just does grassroots education. But what we try to do at ANR Foundation is creating an environment that is conducive to the passage of laws. And advocacy is not lobbying. So to start the story, really from Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights, which actually started off as Northern California GASP, Group Against Smoking Pollution, it was in the mid-70s. And the birth of the non-smokers' rights movement truly was a grassroots, individual, citizen-driven movement. Just people were saying, hey, does, you know, like, smoke bother you? Yeah, it kind of bothers me. We should do something about this. Hey, I know, let's pass a state law, because that's easy, right? At the time, there was little to no science about secondhand smoke. We knew that there was science about the health effects of smoking on the smoker, and we were starting to think, to see some science about spouses of smokers, but really there was no science. So the legislative goal at the time was at least to say, hey, I want to make my desk get smoke-free, so when the boss comes by, that person isn't smoking. In the mid-70s, there were two attempts to try to get statewide laws, and that didn't work. Ooh, is there a mouse or something here? Oh, yes, here it is, right here. I'm sorry. So the two attempts to pass a statewide law failed, but let me show you what we were talking about in the 70s that was just earth-shattering and frightening to the tobacco companies, oops, at that time. That is assuming I can get the technology to work. No, I cannot. Okay.
Oh, is it like an embedded?
And I don't know how to... I'm going to leave it alone, and basically, I'll act it out. No. So on this side of the room, what does this say, by the way? Scrolling feature, how do I just get out of it? So on one side, so this side of the room is the happy families, and you're eating dinner in the restaurant, and on this side of the room, there's some families, but there's some older gent and a woman with a really long cigarette holder who looks like she's from the 20s smoking a cigarette, and, you know, the families are all, and it's like, you know, what we could do is have smoking and non-smoking, and they poke. The families point to the smoking site and say, go over there. And it's like, that's the right solution. We should have sections. Well, at the time, we didn't have the science that said there was a better idea or that secondhand smoke was dangerous. So that was what we were working on. And at that time in the 70s, again, just as a point of information, there really wasn't any government funding of, say, a local anti-tobacco program, or most certainly not a grassroots, you know, advocacy program. It really was citizens who cared meeting in living rooms, getting together, and accidentally stumbling upon going to their local city council and saying, you know what, city council, we would like in the city of Berkeley to have smoke-free sections in restaurants and at workplaces. And that was kind of the beginning of the movement, and Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights then started working on these policies for sections within workplaces and restaurants. Well, fast forward to the 1980s, we finally get the first Surgeon General's report in 1986 on the health effects of secondhand smoke, which, by the way, at the time was called environmental tobacco smoke. And just again, for your information, we as an advocacy organization and as a tobacco control community don't talk about environmental tobacco smoke, in large part because it's a term that was coined by the tobacco industry. Because, hey, it's in the environment. It's not the smoke, it's not the cigarette, it's sick building syndrome. It's not the cigarette. So we coined the term secondhand smoke, or it was passive smoking, because again, it was the non-smoker was being victimized by the smoke that they didn't want to be exposed to. So in 1986, then Surgeon General C. Everett Koop came out with this landmark report, and one of the key points that we walked away with for the non-smokers' rights movement was the statement that the simple separation of the smoker from the non-smoker was insufficient to protect the non-smoker from exposure to secondhand smoke. And, you know, we started to have more research on looking at the health effects of secondhand smoke on the non-smoker. And that, again, then changed our policy goal of what we were going to look for. It was no longer sections of restaurants, but it was going to be entirely smoke-free restaurants. Now, at that time, they were pushing for the bar within the restaurant to have smoking because, gosh, clearly everybody who drinks smokes, right? Well, that was the industry argument because, again, you know, all the vices go together. As we get to present time, we'll talk about casinos and how all of that smoking and drinking and all of that goes together. In the 1980s, we also started to see federal funding of statewide or state initiatives. So you had programs like Commit and Assist. It was in 1987 that we started to have hearings about smoking on planes. In fact, we never, as an organization, thought about making airplanes smoke-free until a flight attendant called us. Again, this was an employee who was negatively affected in her work environment by exposure to secondhand smoke, and a very colorful flight attendant told us that smoking on an airplane was like pulmonary rape. They could not avoid it. They were being exposed to it. They didn't want it. And there you go. Yeah, she was a fabulous spokesperson. She and then all the other more sort of polite and lovely flight attendants, or actually stewardesses at the time. And then in 1988, we saw, again, sort of this power of working at the lower level of government, mentioned in the beginning in the 70s, tried to get a state law, didn't work out real well. Why? Tobacco industry influence and lobbying at the state houses. Local level, we had more control. We were the citizens who lived in those communities. Well, in 1987, when they started having these discussions about smoke-free airlines at the federal level, the discussion started, but the state of California had authority to pass a regulation about smoking about in-state flights, so flights that within the state of California then went smoke-free. And in 1988, you also had the California Tobacco Tax Initiative that passed a whopping tax, 25 cents. A nickel of that went to education, and it was divided between health education and school education. But it created a phenomenal program with the dedication of funding every local state health department and created millions of dollars in the early days to create community-based programs to really educate every person in the state of California about the health hazards of secondhand smoke, the benefits of quitting smoking, and I think most importantly, about tobacco industry behavior, that they were not your friends. That, you know, when you smoked a cigarette and you used it from both ends, that it caused harm whether you smoked it or you were exposed to secondhand smoke. So during the 80s, this whole decade, we really started to see changes where the non-smokers' rights movement went from being this scrappy, citizen-driven movement to one that was pretty heavily funded. And that started to change a little bit of the dynamics. Now, that didn't have to change the role of the advocate, but there was some conflict. And I actually started working in California in 1989 because of the California tobacco tax, where my interest first started off as cancer control, and I had worked at the National Cancer Institute as a research fellow. Never wanted to work on tobacco control because I thought it was smoking cessation. And sadly, I'm just not that patient to work on an individual basis. But by discovering this comprehensive program and working, you know, both at the policy and environmental level was appealing to me. But I also met, for the first time, you know, real grassroots individuals. And it was interesting seeing public health professionals working with people who just said, damn it, it's the right thing to do. Why are you dragging your feet? Let's get moving. We don't need science. Let's go. Well, the good news is that we were able to work the advocates with the science community and with our other partners in the community who just didn't want to see any more damage done to the community, and we built a real strong coalition of diverse folks. Now, success breeds what? More interference from the tobacco industry. You know you're doing a good job when, A, you get called names. You know, you're Left Coast granola-eating health Nazi. Wear it as a badge of honor. And when they start, of course, directly attacking all of your advocacy work. We started to see preemption at the state level pass. Florida was one of the first that passed a very explicit preemption language. We had seen lots of counties throughout the state of Florida passing local clean indoor air laws. They weren't necessarily the 100%, but then there was legislation at the state level, driven in large part by tobacco industry lobbyists, that basically said any and all activity that deals with smoke-free or tobacco control must happen at the state level. The locals have no control. Michigan had actually technically enacted the first one, but it was sort of vague preemption language. I'm going to go a little bit more quickly as we get to current time because folks may have experienced this a little bit more. But in the 90s, the California Tobacco Control Program was in full swing with throughout the state. The National Airline Smoking Ban was implemented in February of 1990. By the way, the flight attendants loved it. The pilots weren't very happy about it because they liked to smoke in the cockpit. Again, our legislative goal, our policy goal was 100% smoke-free. But again, we didn't have science in the 90s that we could, you know, clearly demonstrate that ventilation did not mitigate the negative health effects of, you know, the smoke. EPA in the early 90s labeled secondhand smoke, again, they called it ETS, as a Class A carcinogen, which was a huge boon. And I'm going to show you a graph of the passage of local laws by year in California. And you see these spikes when you get these seminal reports. RWJ started investing funds for the Smokeless States Project. And then California in 1994 passed one of the first statewide workplace restaurant and bar law. The bars were being phased in what was supposed to be 2 years. Because of industry interference, it ended up being 3. It is true that the California workplace law has some minor loopholes in it and with respect to, you know, businesses with 5 or fewer employees. But it was really the first state that included bars in any sort of state-regulated gaming. We don't have casinos. At the time, we didn't have Indian casinos. Tribal casinos are sovereign, and so they are not governed by the state law. But racetracks, card rooms, et cetera, were covered. Of course, again, success breeds the opposition. And throughout the 90s, we saw the creation of multiple front groups and this whole, we're going to lose 30% of business if we go smoke-free. And it was a number that was just chosen out of the air. This particular article is from Consumer Reports, where they basically document that this is a made-up number. I just had to point out because I think it's kind of funny. So ANR has this kind of little silly bird, you know, sort of that voice who could say things like, "Ah, you can't believe the industry." So ANR bird is tipping his hat. The National Smokers Alliance, which is a front group that was created by Philip Morris, populated by Philip Morris employees, and then those smokers who signed up for coupons, and they added them just willy-nilly then to this National Smokers Alliance to pretend they had an actual grassroots organization. They created the resistance bird. Again, I kind of sort of take that as a compliment. It's like, really? How many people have birds as their mascots? I think this was a direct, you know, counter to ANRs. Again, when you know you're doing the right thing, when they just wage an all-out attack, these are just two sample ads where the ANR Foundation, along with the American Heart Association, had some funding from the California Wellness Foundation to point out the benefit of the Prop 99-funded education, media, and other campaigns. And so then Governor Pete Wilson, this was before the master settlement and before we had all this wealth of internal tobacco industry documents, people gave ANR secret documents. We had our own sort of secret insiders and whistleblowers who would say, you know, you really need to know about this, and you can't say where you got it, but here's a memo I think you should read. And one of them where the tobacco companies were saying, don't worry, Pete's still on our side. And so you can't really see that in the internal memo here, but it really documents that. And so we were able to, as an advocacy organization, turn that over to the media and let them expose what the industry was doing. So again, I actually sort of ran out of time here on this one. As we've gone forward over the last, almost 4 decades, Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights was established in 1976. And over time, you know, we have seen changes in how much funding there is for these programs. While we do still have some funds, I think we're kind of going back to our roots, if you will, back to the grassroots, because the way that we win these campaigns, whether it's tobacco, alcohol, food, earlier today there was the prescription drug discussion, is you have to tell the story of the people who are affected by the problem. And so whether it's, you know, the health department's role can be that you can organize the coalition, people may call you for assistance, whether it's to quit smoking or, you know, you live in an apartment and you're being exposed to smoke, where can I turn to for help? And every individual who calls you is then someone who is potentially can be involved in an advocacy campaign. They can become the voice saying, you know, the health department gave me some assistance, and we were then able to go, you know, quit smoking or have smoke-free housing. The role of the professional funded professionals, you know, can generate all of the resources and tools that then advocates can use to go forward to advocate and or, when the time comes, lobby. It's just going to be sort of a push and pull of who takes, you know, that sort of front and center role at what time. Prior to any legislation being introduced, the health department can be very upfront and vocal. When the campaign is introduced or when the bill is introduced, when I was at the health department, I would have to take a step back. And if people from the community would say, well, Cynthia, why don't you give testimony? It's like, I can't just walk in and do it. Why don't you, as the community member, tell the council, I know someone in the health department who has information, invite her to testify. And then when they would ask me, well, what's your position on this bill or on this ordinance, it's like, well, you know, the research shows that smoke-free laws are good for health and good for business, and all the science shows, and X number of cities have these laws. But what's your position? Well, I'm at the health department, so the research says, and, you know. But I think that there's a coalition of wonderful advocates and residents from here who can actually speak to that. So, again, the partnership between those who are funded and the advocates on the ground really needs to be nourished. So to wrap up, we've made a lot of progress. We are continuing to move forward. We're going from beyond smoke-free indoor spaces like workplaces, restaurants, and bars. We're looking at casinos, which is one of the fastest growing employment opportunities in many states. Unfortunately, lots of smoking on casino floors. We're moving into tobacco-free universities, housing, outdoor spaces, etc. But again, all of these shifts in the movement have been based on public demand and the science. Real quickly, because I'm out of time. No questions for me. We're seeing a plateau in the number of local laws. There have been no new state laws passed in the last 2 years. Everybody cross your fingers and say a good word or think a good thought for North Dakota that has a law on the ballot that would strengthen the current state law. This is the progress we've seen across the nation. This slide is just California. This slide is across the nation, the number of comprehensive, if you will, workplace, restaurant, and bar laws. You can see the peaks and valleys. We're down. This, so far in 2012, there are 52 laws that are either new or amended to be workplace, restaurant, and bar laws. We're getting a lot more protection. Nearly 49% of the U.S. Population is protected. 20% has nothing. 33% has a partial law. And so, you know, it's like maybe just workplaces and restaurants or restaurants and bars. But if we really believe that every worker deserves a smoke-free workplace, we have a lot of work to do. And encouraging cities to go back and strengthen their laws is a challenge, but we need to do it. It's the tobacco industry that is creating these barriers for us and creating that plateau. And again, just as a movement, we have to put the human face on the issue. It's not just Cynthia, the crazy zealot from A&R. Really, the population wants and demands this, and we have resources, and I apologize for going a little long. Thank you.